I want to begin by just saying a kind word back to Matt. I appreciate his kind words Wednesday evening, but I appreciate him for being willing to take the risk and teach with me this quarter. He mentioned the material. I feel it's necessary to pass on the credit there to Stephen. Stephen provided for us the material. We just had to do a little arranging, and we added just the barest few of questions to it as we rearranged it. I have to admit that when Stephen first came to me and told me that we would be studying all of the United Kingdom, the Northern Kingdom first, and then come back and study the Southern Kingdom, I was a little concerned. But I have to say that as I've studied this, I see the wisdom and the value in it. Namely, you have the ability to look and see the flow of the progression of spiritual condition within the kingdoms, respectively. You get a chance to see how God is working with the respective kingdoms to bring about His will, Him calling them back to them, to Himself, even when they are in the midst of idolatry and wickedness. We see a tremendous outpouring both of miracles and of spoken prophets and written prophets through this period, and we tie those in and tie them into where we are in the history of the particular kingdom, northern or southern, that we're studying, helps us to get a better sense of the flow. And there's another sense in which that's very practical, in that this is how God gave it to us, really. If you go through the book of 1 Kings, you come to 1 Kings chapter 12, and you read on through 2 Kings chapter 17, what you're going to get there, by and large, is a very heavy dose of the northern kingdom. There will be some notice of events that also where the southern kingdom's interacting, but mostly you're getting the northern kingdom. And then also when you come to 2 Chronicles chapter 10 and you read through 2 Chronicles chapter 28, what you're getting then is Judah. And again, you'll see where it touches on the northern kingdom, but certainly very heavily focused on the northern kingdom at first, and then the southern kingdom in 2 Chronicles. This is not clicking forward as it was merely 15 minutes ago. I do not suggest to know why. All right, now it is. Thank you. All right, so looking back at the Jeroboam just very briefly, I wanted to say how impressed I was with Matt. He felt a little let down, but I thought he did marvelously. He did, not only did he get in an introduction, but he got in a full lesson. I felt like it was a full lesson on Jeroboam, which was a good bit of material. But let's think back briefly about Jeroboam and ask ourselves, before he became king, when Ahijah the Shilonite came to him and he split that new garment into 12 pieces and he told Jeroboam, you know, you take 12 of these. What were the promises made? You can take 10 of these. What were the promises made to Jeroboam at that time? That's exactly right. In fact, he says, I will allow you to rule over all your heart desires. We don't know what Jeroboam had in mind exactly, but the Lord is making a very special promise to him that he would provide to him all that his heart desired. He would be able to rule over Israel. Well, what about the conditions that God placed? You've already mentioned them. Well, we see them in 1 Kings 11:38. So it shall be, if you will heed all that I command you, walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you, and will build for you an enduring house, as I built for David, and will give Israel to you. So you think about that. He's been given, you know, a promise from God is far greater, really, than a standing army of a million well-prepared men, because it's sure that great army might fail you, but God will not. So when Jeroboam gets to the throne, what does he do but look around? He surveys the landscape and he says, whew, look at all these bad things that can happen to me. These people are going to go back to Jerusalem. They're going to worship there. They're going to return to Rehoboam. And then where am I going to be? I'm not going to be king. In fact, they're going to come on and kill me. So he looked at what all could go wrong and he says, you know, I better take steps to protect myself here. I want to rule over Israel. I want to rule over all my heart desires and to be king. And what does he do? He turns around and does the very thing that ensures that he will not be king. And it's so easy for us to look at Jeroboam and think, that is foolish. How could you do that? I mean, think about this. When Jeroboam's on the throne, what is it that he could look at and say, maybe I should believe what God is telling me about these promises. Maybe I should believe these promises. What can he look at? He had a good, very graphic illustration of failure. That's right. And if you're Jeroboam, sorry, I didn't mean to catch you. Do you have any other? Okay. So if you're Jeroboam and you're sitting on the throne in Israel and you're looking around and you think, how many tribes am I king over? Let's see, 10. Well, that's exactly what Ahijah had said. And the fact that I'm on the throne, out of all of the people that might like to be on the throne, it's me. So he had proof positive that the promises of God were solid and they were tangible, and he could put his trust in them. And I think about us. It's just a small illustration, but I think about, you know, regarding the promises of God. Matthew 6:33 is a beautiful promise. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. The things that we need will be added to you. What do? We're tempted when it comes to, say, for example, benevolence. Well, we look around and we see what bad things could happen. If I get too loose with my purse, you know, I could find myself in want. Well, that's not what God says. And so, you see, we can be tempted with this sort of thinking where we hear the promise of God, but we just kind of let it go past us. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's exactly right. And what does God tell him later? He says, you cast me, we'll look at it in a minute, you cast me behind you. It was as if as soon as he got on the throne, he could not wait to just disregard God. And so that's exactly what he did. Well, Nadab, his son, Jeroboam reigned for 22 years until the second year of Asa ruling down in the south. And his son Nadab comes to the throne. And lo and behold, he too does not take this seriously. He did, as we read in 1 Kings chapter 15:26. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in his sin by which he made Israel sin. So summarize the curse. This is question one in your material. Summarize the curse Ahijah pronounced against the descendants of Jeroboam. That was exactly right. He says there in 1 Kings 14:9 through 11, you've done more evil than all who were before you. For you have gone and made for yourself other gods. I think this is interesting wording, by the way. You remember what Jeroboam said when he set up the calves? He said, look, Israel, it's your gods that brought you up out of Egypt. But God never attaches himself to that at all. He doesn't look at it as perverted worship of himself, even. I don't think. I think this wording says, nope, these are other gods. They're completely different. They're not anything to do with me. And he says, you've provoked me to anger and have cast me behind your back. Again, that idea that he couldn't wait to throw off any responsibility to God. I will bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam and will cut off from Jeroboam every male in Israel, bond and free. I will take away the remnant of the house of Jeroboam as one takes away refuse until it's gone. Very graphic language. The dogs shall eat whoever belongs to Jeroboam and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the field, for the Lord has spoken, trying to get their attention. You think about what Jeroboam did in setting up these idols and what Nadab is now doing in following through with it. What did Jehovah have a reputation among the nations? Yes, he did. He had a reputation as being the God who brought Israel out of Egypt, who conquered Sihon and Og and brought them into the land of Canaan. He had this reputation of being different. You didn't find a molded image of Jehovah floating around in the markets being sold. So what Jeroboam says is, you know all that you've heard or you thought that you knew about Jehovah? Forget all that. He really is just like all the other gods. He's just a little molded calf. Do you see how that was such a slur against God? So Nadab continued in his sin and in the sin of Jeroboam, his father. At this time, it's very interesting. Israel has gone to war against the Philistines, or at least they're in a border struggle with the Philistines. And they're after this city, Gibbethon. This is a city that we learned back in Joshua belonged to the tribal territory of Dan. And in fact, it was one of the Levitical cities that had been given to the Kohathites. I doubt very seriously that any of that played into Nadab's thinking. I think he was trying to shore up his border. But it is interesting that this city is one that did have some significance for the children of Israel. And far less significant, but just a curiosity that I found about the city, is that this is the area that Delilah was from. So let's take a quick look at it. Just do a little bit of geography and think a little bit about the kingdoms that are in place at this time. So here's Gibbethon. I'm going to advance a little bit to make it a little bit bigger for us. But here it is, Gibbethon. And you can see from this that it's right there on that border both with Judah and with Philistia. And so it would have been, it seems that during this period there's a lot of fortification of border cities. They're trying to make sure that their kingdom is secure, that nobody's encroaching on them. And so that most likely is what's going on here. Now, this is it not shown on this map. Right here, this is the Aijalon River. There's a valley that goes through here with a brook in it called the Sorek Valley. And again, that's that area Delilah was from. This is a modern picture of that area. And this is looking to the west toward the Mediterranean. So Jerusalem is east-southeast behind us here. And you can see the hill country here fade. And then when you get into back further distant there, you'll see the Shephelah, and then it fades on out to the coastal plain and ultimately into the Mediterranean. Gibbethon would have been somewhere in this area here. And I don't know if you find this interesting, but this is, again, looking back out toward the Mediterranean. You see these little clouds? There are several of them in there. I don't know if you can pick them out. But do those clouds, as you think about a certain prophet looking back out over the Mediterranean in a little cloud? So I couldn't help but notice that. Those clouds look like little bitty, about the size of a man's hand. So Nadab's focusing on the Philistines. This has been an enemy, obviously, of Israel for a very long time. They will still be besieging Gibbethon 25 years later. And in fact, we're going to see another important event happen there in about 25 years in our study. But it'll happen today on our study, by the way. So there are other enemies that we need to be thinking about in the area that are growing in strength at this time. Who was it? I believe Matt mentioned this Wednesday evening. Who was it that the Lord raised up in Syria against Solomon before he left the throne? Started with an R. Say it. Yeah, somebody said it. Rezin, or reason, however you want to say it. Well, very soon, you know, he seemed to make some progress consolidating his power there, but Israel don't really seem to recognize the danger there. They're, like I say, they're still focused on Philistia. But by the time we get to Ben-Hadad, we'll see that he has consolidated his power, and he will have 32 kings in his alliance. When he comes up against Ahab, the force is so overwhelming that Ahab will capitulate immediately. And so things have changed a lot, are going to change a lot in the next three decades here. And also gaining power is over in Assyria. Assyria had been a kingdom for a very long time. Not an empire like they will become, but they're the ones who are going to ultimately fulfill the prophecy that we looked at Wednesday night. Let's look back at it. I think this is an important point that Matt made. 1 Kings 14, verses 15 and 16. For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers and will scatter them beyond the river because they have made their wooden images, provoking the Lord to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, who sinned and who made Israel sin. So let's talk just a little bit about when that's going to happen. This map here shows the extent of what Assyria will become, not what they are. But I've made a couple of little modifications to show us where we are. So first of all, in Assyria, they're just a kingdom here between the Tigris and Euphrates. They've got a ruler named Adad-nirari II. It's interesting that his predecessor, Adad-nirari I, is the one who came up with the idea. They had conquered territory. They've been around for well over 1,000 years, waxed and waned in their power. But he's the one that came up with the idea, hey, if we will take the people that we conquer and then we'll scatter them to other lands, then they won't be near the problem that we've had in the past. Because it seemed like every time Assyria kind of grew, they had problems maintaining it because the people would start rebelling. So, and this worked really well. So this is about 200 years after that innovation. And you'll notice that up north of Assyria, there's this kingdom called the Mitanni Kingdom. And then you'll see Babylon down here. They're all three, Assyria, Mitanni, and Babylon, are all three in that fertile area in the Mesopotamian river valley that are prospering. There, just prior to this, incidentally, there had been a huge migration of peoples in this area. The Medes and the Persians had kind of moved into this area. One other note, too, the Hittites, I didn't show them, but they're up here north of the Mediterranean. And they're kind of waning. They're going to be going away. Egyptian rule down here at this time, this is around 900 B.C., they're, you'll recall, under the rule of Shishak, or as the Egyptians called him, Sheshonk, he will make massive inroads against Judah early on because of their wickedness. We'll look more at that when we look in 2 Chronicles, but he's the one that's going to take away basically all of the treasure of Solomon. And history tells us that he overlaid his temples with gold. Well, guess where he got it? He got it from Solomon's rule. But incidentally, Orsakon, his son, who will be next on the throne down there, that will give Judah some problems, at least in the incursions into the area of Philistia. But you'll see then, Assyria is, they're mainly bottled up in here, but this is right about the time that a period begins that's called the Neo-Assyrian period. But it culminates in what you see on the map, with Assyria being that really that first true major empire in this section. And as you can see where we're headed, Israel is under Assyrian control. I just found that interesting to note as we went through here. So Jeroboam has died. His son Nadab has come to the throne. He's besieging the city of Gibbethon in northern Philistia. Baasha is evidently down there with Nadab, and he conspires against Nadab to kill him. And so he is murdered. And this is the first king that we come to, either in the United Kingdom or the Divided Kingdom, who gains the throne by murder. But he is not the last. Quick tally. Of the 39 kings that will rule in both Judah and Israel, fully 13 of them will be murdered by their own people. Most of these in the north. Two, at least two, will be killed in battle, and then another 5 taken by enemies. So a quick tally gives us 20 out of 39. So the odds are, if you're a king during this period of time, you're going to come to some sort of a violent end. I don't know why the people wanted that, they had that lust for power, because it usually ended very poorly. But this also highlights the fact that what kind of a period are we talking about here? Is this a period of, you know, for Israel especially, is this a good period of quiet and stability? A precipitous fall into unfaithfulness. That's well put. And did it have to be that way? No, those promises were so... God did not want this for them. You know, Israel had rejected God from being king long before, but he's not against them. He's still trying to nurture them, even under the worst of circumstances. Yes. Yeah. It's these things are written for our learning and admonition, are they not? I mean, we can see so graphically the results of obedience and trust in God's promise, and we can see very graphically the results of disobedience and a lack of trust in God. So there will be 9 dynasty changes in Israel alone. Quick question, how many in Judah? Real dynasty changes, not interruptions. None. Yeah, and that's just as God had promised too. Well, Baasha makes no pretense about it. He goes in and he wipes out the family of Jeroboam completely, just as Ahijah the Shilonite had promised he would do. In 1 Kings chapter 15, verses 29 through 30, in 30. This is because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he had sinned and by which he made Israel sin, because of his provocation with which he had provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, are they not written? I'm sorry, I missed my verse. 29. And it was so when he became king that he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam anyone that breathed until he had destroyed him according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So Jeroboam, and make a mental note here. Who's doing this? Baasha. What is he doing? Wiping them out. Okay. What's going to happen? One's in the city, the dogs are going to eat. One's in the country, the birds of the air are going to eat. Who's witnessing these things? Baasha is witnessing these things. He's bringing them to about. Okay. So what happened after Baasha took the throne that added, this was my unfair question, that added to the spiritual strength in Judah? That's right. So do you see this is the second time this has occurred? We already saw that many of the righteous, the Levites, had gone down and others had gone down into Judah whenever the kingdom divided. Now they see, they look to the north, or rather to the south, and they see that Asa's ruling. It's a period of relative peace, but there was a peace for 10 years there. And Asa's got all these reforms going that are good, and so they move down. Israel is becoming weaker and weaker spiritually, less families to protest against this wickedness, this dissension into wickedness. Meanwhile, Judah is becoming stronger, and the numbers of the two countries, the two kingdoms, is growing more equal. So this is when Hanani, the son of Jehu, Jehu, the son of Hanani, comes on the scene in 1 Kings 16. Then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, "Inasmuch as I lifted you out of the dust and made you ruler over my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel sin to provoke me to anger with their sins, surely I will take away the posterity of Baasha and the posterity of his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat." Now listen to the language. "The dogs shall eat whoever belongs to Baasha and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the field." So if you think practically about how something like this happens, when Baasha came in and wiped out Jeroboam's family, and I mean wiped them out, what do you think's going on there? His standing order is likely, kill them, don't bury them, let them lay where they drop. So does Baasha have a visual of what this prophecy means? Yeah, he knows what this looks like. He's seen it. He did it. So don't you think that when he hears these words, that he would be affected deeply by it? I mean, after all, Ahab, when Ahab is told very bad news concerning his kingdom, what does he do? He humbled himself. And God said, I'm not going to do it in his days. I'm going to do it in the days of his son. But Baasha, no indication whatsoever that he does that. Wipes out, he's wiped out the family of Jeroboam. He's told the same thing's going to happen to him. He has an opportunity to repent, but he's unwilling to do that. Well, one of the last things we hear about Baasha is that he attacked Judah late in his reign. He attacked them in the 25th year, and he will die in the 26th year of Asa. We'll study this in more detail when we're studying the southern kingdom. Well, his son Elah comes to the throne, and he reigns from the 26th and the 27th. So about 2 years, and it's in the 26th year of Asa. Asa will rule for 41 years, incidentally. And he continued in the sins of his father, Jeroboam, and this is when God decides that he's going to do this. He tells us why. When Zimri, however you prefer, comes against Elah and wipes out all of the posterity of Baasha, it's for all the sins of Baasha and the sins of Elah, his son, by which they had sinned and which they had made Israel to sin, in provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their idols. And so the Lord is bringing this about. He's going to use a man named Zimri, who happens to be captain over half of the chariots of Elah. Now, Israel, well, before we talk about that, we've got Elah. What's he doing at the time of his death? This just highlights, again, the dissension into depravity. Yeah, that's right. He's drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, his steward, back in Tirzah. The capital, incidentally, has shifted from Shechem in the beginning over to Tirzah, and then a bit later, as in this lesson, we're going to see shifts over to Samaria. So he's drinking himself drunk. That's just beautiful picture. And Zimri comes in. It's a conspiracy, so he's got others with him. Whether or not Arza is part of that, we don't know. But he kills him, and he seems to have some might in this. He completely wipes out the family of Baasha, does so with impunity. Now, you think about it. He's only on the throne 7 days, and he's going to wipe them out extremely quickly. Came to pass that when he began to reign, as soon as he was seated on his throne, barely seated on his throne, that he killed all the household of Baasha and did not leave him one male. Now, listen to this, looking to the extent of this. Neither of his relatives nor of his friends. How wonderful for Israel that we have people so very ruthless that they're willing to wipe out a family, friends, relatives, whoever gets in the way. So Zimri's thinking, hey, this is going really well, no doubt. We've taken all of that family of Baasha out of the way. This is going to go just like Baasha. I'm going to be on the throne. Maybe I'll get 20, 30 years of reigning out of this. But it doesn't work out that way because he's miscalculated. As I mentioned, the Israelites are down in Gibbethon again. This is 25 years after we mentioned earlier. They're laying siege to it. Still haven't gotten it. Well, when the news gets back down to Gibbethon, Zimri has conspired, killed the king. He's on the throne. The military leader said, no, that's not going to happen. We don't want Zimri. He didn't count on that. So they quit. They laid off of Gibbethon. They all go back to Tirzah. They lay siege to Tirzah, and it falls quickly. Well, Zimri, being the forethoughtful person that he is, does not have a plan B at all. He's not even in a position to mount a fight. It's over, and he knows it's over. So he goes into the citadel of the king in the king's palace, and he burns it down on himself and dies. And so that was a very, very short-lived dynasty. I think that strains the definition of dynasty, but it certainly ended quickly. Okay. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to somebody else. Mm-hmm. Even the military was.
That's right. That's right. That's right. It was. Yeah. The world has a saying, the world is reigned by the aggressive use of force. And that was the standing policy in Israel because they were not faithful to God. Well, as you mentioned, Tibni, the son of Ginath, he wanted to be king, and some pretty good number of the people wanted him to be king as well. And so for 4 years, from the 27th year of Asa until the 31st year of Asa, there was war, a civil war of sorts. But by and by, the ones that followed Tibni, they began to wane, and Omri began to consolidate his power, and Tibni was killed. 1 Kings chapter 16, 21. Then the people of Israel were divided into two parts. Half followed Tibni, the son of Ginath, to make him king, and half followed Omri. And those who followed Omri were victorious in the end after about a four-year struggle, as we mentioned. Omri reigns an additional 8 years. Says he reigned for 6 years in Tirzah. Then he bought the hill of Shemer, from him, and he named his capital Samaria. It looks like he reigned there for about 6 years. And let's read 1 Kings 16, 25 through 26. It says, Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now, it's hard to upstage the people who came before him, the Jeroboams and the Nadabs and the Elahs. But Omri did worse than all who were before him, for he walked in the ways of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and in his sin by which he made Israel sin, provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their idols. And so he's as wicked as they were, and then some. And he'll reign, as we said, for 12 years until about the 38th year of Asa. It's interesting that the Assyrians have contact with with Israel by now, and they're still taking care of Samaria. They're going to take Samaria completely out of the picture here in a few dozen years or so. And they ascribe Jehu to be of the family of Omri. They didn't recognize any dynasty changing. So let's notice this, the closing remarks on our lesson for today. God's people wanted a king. And I ask the question here, what governed the people, or at least most of the people during the period of the judges? What was the rule that governed most people? Whatever seemed good. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And everybody, man did that which was right in his own eyes. Okay? So I guess you could call that a libertarian kind of a society. Everybody just did what they wanted to. Well, now they got a king. What's he doing? He's doing what's right in his eyes. So now you've got a dictatorship. And how's that working out? You wanted it. You thought he was going to fight your battles. You weren't seeing that he was going to wipe out families, whole families in your kingdom and murder one another for the throne. That isn't what you saw. Although, were they warned? They were warned sternly. No, but we will have a king. That just never, ever works. When God says something, he means it. And it is for our good always. So the king's doing what's right in his eyes. There are different forms of government. And I want to point out this verse. Hiram Hutto pointed this verse out to me many years ago. And I think it is a good verse to have in our mind that summarizes the whole period, a lesson we can learn. This is Asa down in the southern kingdom. We'll look at this later. Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. Is that any less true today? And it's just not. All right, we'll pick back up with Ahab on Wednesday evening.